2 Samuel 15:13 through 16:23, the ninth talk in a series on 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on May 2, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The story that we're following is Absalom, who's going to try to usurp the throne from David. All of this action was set up by something that happened, an event that happened that set in chain a whole series of events. That was when Amnon, the firstborn son of David, to his second wife, he had no children by the first wife, Amnon raped his half-sister, a daughter born to David by his third wife. And after that happened, David was angry, but David took no action against Amnon. Absalom, Tamar, the woman who was raped, Absalom, the brother of Tamar, was infuriated by that event, by what happened, and apparently because David did not take any action, he decided to take action. He waited 2 years, waiting for the right opportunity, and then he and his servants put Amnon to death. They killed him. Then Absalom left, obviously afraid of what David might do in response to that. So Absalom left and went to Geshur, a kingdom to the northeast of Israel, where his grandfather was the king. He stayed there for a couple of years, and during which time David's anger towards Absalom apparently subsided, and Joab set up a situation in which David would be forced to rethink his actions towards Absalom, and he was successful in getting David to rethink that. And so David asked Joab then to get Absalom and bring him back from Geshur to Israel, to Jerusalem. And Joab gladly did so. But once Absalom got it to Jerusalem, David would not see him. David would not reconcile with Absalom. And it wasn't until a couple years later that Absalom forced the issue and a reconciliation did take place. But by this time, Absalom is obviously bitter towards David, and he begins to take some action to put himself in a position to be able to take power away from David. What he does is he begins to station himself outside the city gates of Jerusalem. And whenever people would come for justice, when people would come with a case that they wanted David and his administration to hear, Absalom would talk to them and ask them where they were from and that sort of thing, ask them what their case was, and then Absalom would say, "I would rule in your favor." And he would then go on to say, "Wouldn't it be great if I were the judge in Jerusalem?" And by so doing, over a 4-year period of time, Absalom has generated for himself a lot of goodwill on the part of the people of Israel. Then Absalom decides that the time is right, and he tells David that he wants to make a sacrifice, that he had promised that he would make a sacrifice when he was away in Geshur, and now the time is right for him to do so. he asked David's leave for him to go to Hebron, where he will offer this special sacrifice. David grants him permission, and there are 200 people from Jerusalem, presumably many of them administrators, that all go to Hebron with him. So that's where he goes, and at that point in time, then, he declares himself king of all Israel. And he has already arranged it so that simultaneously in places throughout Israel, there are messengers sent by him who will declare him to be king. So Absalom has made his move. He's claiming to be king of all of Israel. And as the author says in verse 13 of chapter 15, no, I'm sorry, 12 of chapter 15, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So he has considerable support for what he's doing, and it's throughout the land of Israel that he has this support. That's where the action left off last week. So we'll start with verse 13 of chapter 15. Then a messenger came to David, saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise, and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." Then the king's servant said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever your lord the king chooses." So the king went out, and all his household with him. But the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out, and all the people with him, and they stopped at the last house. Now all his servants passed on beside him, all the Cherethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had come with him from Gath, passed on before the king. So a messenger arrives. It doesn't say who the messenger is, but the messenger seems to be reliable. The messenger says that the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. This is bad news. What David is hearing from this messenger is that throughout Israel, Absalom has significant support. So this means that this is a genuine attempt to usurp the throne that David is facing. So David is going to have to act quickly. It's in all likelihood the messenger has not only brought the news that that Absalom has a lot of support, but presumably he has also brought the news that they are on their way to Jerusalem. So David needs to act quickly. What he decides is that he can't stay there, and it's not clear why he doesn't want to stay in Jerusalem, whether he doesn't feel like he has the manpower to defend it, whether he just wants to spare Jerusalem the disruption and the death that would occur when Absalom marches in. But for whatever reason, David decides that the most prudent course of action is for him and his followers to get out of town. His friends, his followers, they're willing to do whatever he wants. They're willing to fight if that's what he chooses to do. They're willing to flee if that's what he chooses to do. They're willing to stay if that's what he chooses to do. But David's choice is for them to flee, and flee as quickly as possible. He decides that he is going to leave 10 concubines in Jerusalem. It's not clear why this is the case. It says that to keep the house. He leaves the 10 concubines to keep the house. I suspect that what's happening here is that in the palace and the areas around the palace, David probably has a large number of servants and their families. And there is no way that David can take all of them. So he's going to have to leave them behind. But they're going to need some kind of supervision. There's going to have to be some kind of administration to make sure that they that things continue to operate, that they're continued to they are provided for, et cetera, et cetera. So presumably that's why he decides to leave the 10 concubines behind. I suspect it's a calculated decision. As we'll see, he's making several calculated decisions here. He's trying to decide who can he leave behind in safety and who has to come with him. And the decisive factor is how closely are they going to be associated with him and his rule. If they are closely associated with him and his rule, then they will be in jeopardy. If there's some distance there, then Absalom will probably leave them alone. It is, by the way, general practice in this time that when you decide that you want to become king, that if you mount such a rebellion, you have to kill your opponent. Because if you don't kill the king that is on the throne, then that, even though you take power, that king will always be a source of potential opposition in the future. So standard practice is to kill the king that you replace. So David knows that's in all likelihood what will happen, and his closest advisors will also be put to death. So that's the decision that David's making, is who do I have to take? And clearly, he wants to take as few as he can in order for them to move quickly and be able to get away. So he makes this strategic decision. He decides to leave 10 concubines to take care of the household, but otherwise his wives and children presumably are going with him. The people that go out include, it says, the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and the Gittites, the 600 men who had come with him from Gath. If you will recall, there was another time when David had to flee in order to save his life. That was when he learned that when Saul was king, Saul wanted to kill David and had issued orders that that be done. Jonathan told David that that was the case, and David took off. That's important. There are several points at which that story comes to bear on this one. But one of those is he goes to the Philistines, and that's where he lives for a period of time. And while he's there, around him, he accumulates a small army of men who fight with him, and they stay with him throughout the rest of his life. We'll see that even at the end of 2 Samuel, when he's about to die, it lists those people who had remained with him from the time that he went, from the time that he fled Saul into Philistia. And those are called the mighty men. And there were about 600 of them. And it's referring to them here. So they are packing up and leaving with him as he departs from Jerusalem at this point in time. Next section. Then the king said to Ittai, the Gittite, "Why will you also go with us? Return and remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile. Return to your own place. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you a wanderer with us while I go where I will? Return and take back your brothers. Mercy and truth be with you." But Ittai answered the king and said, "As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, surely wherever my lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be." Therefore David said to Ittai, "Go and pass over." So Ittai the Gittite passed over with all his men and all the little ones who were with him, while all the country was weeping with a loud voice. All the people passed over. The king also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. Ittai is someone that has not been mentioned in the text previously. Ittai is apparently, from what it says here, was a Philistine who had just recently come to live in Jerusalem. So he apparently had just recently decided to be to leave Philistia and serve under David as king. And what David is saying to him is, there's no reason that you have to come with me. That the tie between me and you is not so strong that you are going to be in danger. You could safely stay here in Jerusalem. Absalom is very unlikely to kill you because there isn't that kind of close tie. And so you might as well stay here, as David puts it. He says, return and remain with the king, indicating that in David's mind, Absalom has already taken power. But in any case, the suggestion is Ittai should go back to Jerusalem and just ride this thing out. If Absalom is victorious, Ittai can serve him. If there's some way that David is able to retain power, then Ittai can serve him. But why come with us? Why risk it and come with us? You're safe to stay in Jerusalem. Ittai's response is, he says, as the Lord lives, and as my God the king lives, surely wherever my Lord the king may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be. For Ittai, there's no question what he's going to do. Ittai's allegiance is not to Israel as much as it is to David personally. And so Ittai is willing to hitch his fate to David's fate. He's willing to risk it because he is so committed to David as an individual. So Ittai asks that he can go and that and David grants him permission. So Ittai and all of his family, including his children, go, and all of his men, all of them, are allowed to go on with David. So we've got this whole entourage, and it's quite a number of people. It's probably a few thousand people that are headed out from Jerusalem, and they've passed over the Kidron Valley, and they're headed towards the Mount of Olives. And they're all in a state of mourning. They're all weeping with a loud voice, and we'll see later that they're all wearing the attire that one would wear when you're in mourning. Next section. Now behold, Zadok also came, and all the Levites with him, carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God, and Abiathar came up until all the people had finished passing from the city. And the king said to Zadok, return the Ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. The king said also to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and your two brothers with you, your two sons with you, your son Ahimaaz, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I am going to wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar returned the Ark of God to Jerusalem and remained there. So as this entourage is all headed out of Jerusalem, the priests pick up the Ark of the Covenant from the tabernacle, presumably, and they start following after David, and they want to come along too. And so David sees them here, and he has to make the decision, what are we going to do? And presumably what the priests are thinking is there would be a lot of significance to the Ark of the Covenant being with David. That would probably be significant to a large number of people within Israel, and that this might give him an advantage. if not just a psychological advantage, that there may even be a spiritual advantage to him having the Ark of the Covenant. The Israelites had thought of the Ark of the Covenant in those terms earlier in 1 Samuel when they took the Ark of the Covenant into a battle against the Philistines. So I'm not sure exactly what their thinking is, but clearly they think that it would be an advantage for the Ark of the Covenant to be with David. And the ones that are carrying it are Zadok. Zadok is the high priest. Zadok joined David when he went to when he was still fleeing from Saul, when he was in the Judean desert, I think. Or did he join him when he got to Hebron? I can't remember. But he's been with David for a long time. And he's been very loyal to David. The other one, Abiathar. Abiathar was the priest who had been at Nob when David fled from Saul. So this is going back to the event when David fled from Saul. Saul had decided to kill David. David fled with his men. They were obviously in a great hurry. They had no weapons with them. They had no food with them. They stopped at Nob, and they asked the priest there if they had any food. And the only food that was available was the showbread that was in the tabernacle. And David said, that'll work. So they gave David the showbread, and David and his men ate it, and they also got the sword that David had used to behead Goliath, and then they took off. Later, when Saul found out that the priests had aided David in his escape, Saul killed all of the priests. There was only one that escaped, and that was Abiathar. Abiathar escaped that slaughter, fled to David, and David said, stay with me and I will protect you. So this is the same man then now that is fleeing with David, the man to whom David has been so gracious. So those are the two priests that come carrying the Ark of the Covenant. David looks at the Ark of the Covenant and his judgment is, it ought not come with us. And there may be many reasons for why the Ark of the Covenant shouldn't come with them. But what David says is, take it back. If God restores me, I will return to it. I will be reunited with it. He says, if I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. Presumably, that's the tabernacle. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here I am, let him do to me as seems good to him. So the alternative is that David would die, and if that's what's going to happen, then that's fine. That's God's pleasure. That's God's choice. And David is content with that. So on that basis, he says, take the Ark of the Covenant back. But he turns to Zadok and he says, you're a seer. And he doesn't say this to Abiathar, but Abiathar, you're one of the high priests. David says, you don't need to come with me. His thinking seems to be that they are of such a status that that Absalom is not going to touch them. They're safe. So he tells them, go on back and stay in Jerusalem. And David actually sees an opportunity here. David realizes that they could be a source of information for him about what is going on in Jerusalem. So he says, go back, and when you get information, then you send that to me via their two sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan. In verse 28, he says, see, I am going to wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So he's going to stay at a certain point in the wilderness until he gets information from them as to what he should that would help him decide what he should do from there. So they are going to provide information for him. So the priests and the ark, they go back, just as David had asked. Next section. And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and wept as he went. And his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. It happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, that behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, If you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so I will now be your servant, then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So it shall be that whatever you hear from the king's house, you shall report to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send me everything that you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. So they're going up. They've crossed over the Kidron, and now they're going up to the top of the Mount of Olives, and then they're going to go further east once they cross the Mount of Olives. And he is weeping, and he has his head covered, and he's walking barefoot. It's all indications of him being in mourning. And the people with him are also in mourning as they proceed. And you can imagine the scene at this point. They're all wondering who has sided with whom. Now, we've got a rebellion underway. We're on the verge of a civil war. And the question is, as people choose up sides, who's siding with David and who is siding with Absalom? And apparently they get news that Ahithophel has decided to side with Absalom. Ahithophel has been a counselor to David for a long period of time. He is apparently David's wisest advisor. We see that later on. That's mentioned in the text. So it must have been a significant blow to David for one of his most capable and trusted advisors to decide to go over to Absalom. Ahithophel was, by the way, related to Bathsheba, and that may have played a role in his decision. So when David hears that Ahithophel has decided to go with Absalom, he makes a prayer, and his prayer is, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. So David is hoping that, given that Ahithophel has gone with Absalom, he's hoping that God will somehow make Ahithophel's counsel no good, counterproductive even. And it's just at that time then, reaching the summit of the Mount of Olives, that David runs into Hushai. And Hushai is there apparently worshiping God. This is a place where God was worshiped. And he has his coat torn and dust on his head, so he too is in a state of mourning. So he apparently has heard about the rebellion and has gone to the summit of the Mount of Olives in order to pray to God. And so David meets him, and so now once again David is faced with this decision. Does he come with us, or does he go back to Jerusalem? Hushai is one of David's closest friends, so he would obviously be potentially in danger. But he says, if you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me, which suggests that Hushai is probably getting along in years. And that seems to be David's concern, that Hushai wouldn't be able to move along as quickly as will be necessary in order for them to escape Absalom. So he's thinking, this is not going to work. He can't come with us. What would plan B be? And plan B is go back to Jerusalem and pretend that you have turned over to Absalom's side, that you are supporting his cause. And in so doing, you can counteract the counsel of Ahithophel. And beyond that, you can also provide information as to what Absalom is planning to do. And the means by which that information will get to David is Hushai will report it to the priests, and the sons of the priests will then come and find David and report that to David. So there's a sense in which this is good fortune, very good fortune, that David has stumbled upon right after having heard the bad news that Ahithophel has gone with Absalom. Next section, chapter 16. Now when David had passed a little beyond the summit, behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a jug of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why do you have these?" And Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride, and the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for whoever is faint in the wilderness to drink." Then the king said, "And where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is staying in Jerusalem. For he said, 'Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me.'" So the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And Ziba said, "I prostrate myself. Let me find favor in your sight, O my lord, the king." So David goes a little bit further, and he encounters another fellow. This is Ziba. He has occurred earlier in the narrative. If you'll recall back at the time after David had become king, he remembered that he had made a covenant with Jonathan, the son of Saul. Jonathan and David had become best friends. And David had promised to Jonathan that he would take care of Jonathan's descendants as long as David lived. He was making an oath that he would do so. Well, a lot transpired between then and when David actually became king. It was a number of years. But David did eventually become king, and king not only of Judea, but king of all of Israel. And once he had done so, he remembered the oath that he had made to Jonathan. And so he sent out word. He tried to find any descendant left of Jonathan with respect to whom David could fulfill the covenant that he had made. And he located a servant who was taking care of Saul's household, all of the estates that Saul had left behind and whatever people Saul had left behind in his household. And that was Ziba. And David called Ziba and asked him, "Are there any descendants of Jonathan left?" And Ziba said, "Yes, there's one. It's Mephibosheth." And once David learned about Mephibosheth, he sent for Mephibosheth and brought him to live in the palace with David. And he gave him all of Saul's belongings, all of Saul's inheritance went to Mephibosheth. But Mephibosheth and his immediate family, they came and lived in the palace with David and ate meals with David and did so on a regular basis from the time that David found him until the events of this chapter. So now we have Ziba meeting David, and he's got two donkeys, and he's got a whole bunch of food. And so David asks him, well, what are you doing here? And Ziba's response is, I've brought all of these things for the king and his household. You can use the donkeys to ride, and here's a whole bunch of food for whoever needs it. And then David says, well, where's Mephibosheth? And if you'll recall, Mephibosheth was lame. He was lame because when the news came to the palace that Saul and his sons had died in battle against the Philistines, all of the servants of Saul, they quickly picked up their belongings and ran out of the palace to save their lives. Apparently they were afraid that the Philistines would come there and kill them as well. And in so doing, one of the servants picked up Mephibosheth, who was a baby at the time, and dropped him. And he became lame for life. So Mephibosheth can't run. And so he would probably have to have help to get away from Jerusalem. So he's asking Ziba, because Ziba would be the one who would be taking care of Mephibosheth, where's Mephibosheth? And here's the response in verse 3. Behold, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me. In other words, Mephibosheth, according to Ziba, is thinking, this is my lucky day. Because now things are in turmoil. David has been driven out of Jerusalem. And perhaps I would have the strongest claim to being the rightful king of Israel. And perhaps I will be installed on the throne. That must have been a stab in the heart for David, to have been so gracious to Mephibosheth for such a long period of time, and to hear that Mephibosheth has turned against him. So David's response is, he turns to Ziba and he says, okay, then everything that I had given to Mephibosheth, it's yours. You will have all of that Saul had left behind. And Ziba responds by bowing down and saying, let me find favor in your sight, O my lord, the king. And whenever anybody says the king to David at this point in time, that's significant, because the question is, who's the king? So he's siding with David. Next section. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came, and he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out! Get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. So David comes to Bahurim. Bahurim is not far out of Jerusalem. And this particular place has been mentioned before in the narrative in a very sad event. If you'll recall, David, before he fled from Saul, was married to Saul's daughter, Michal. But when David fled from Saul and went into Philistia, Saul took Michal and gave her to another man to marry. Well, later, when David became king, he wanted Michal back because he had earned Michal, as you will recall. It was on the basis of having killed, I think it was 200 Philistines, that Saul gave Michal to David. And since she was the daughter of Saul, the king, being married to the daughter of the king strengthened David's claim to the throne. So David insisted that Michal be returned to him. So he sent Joab, his general, out to get Michal and to bring her back to David, to Jerusalem. So he went and got her, but in so doing, he was taking Michal from her husband, the man to whom Saul had married her. And the account says that he followed behind weeping as they went until they got to Bahurim, at which point Joab said, "Get lost." And he took Michal alone. So this particular site has some history. There's a man from the family of the house of Saul, Shimei, who sees David here, sees him fleeing. He knows what's going on. And his assessment of what's going on is that it is God's judgment on David that this is happening. It is God's judgment on him because, and here's what he says, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. So his primary charge against David is that David is a man of bloodshed who wiped out the household of Saul. And he sees all of this as being a just response to what David has done. Next section. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head." But the king said, "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, 'Curse David,' then who shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" Then David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. Perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursing this day." So David and his men went on the way, and Shimei went along the hillside parallel with him, and as he went, he cursed and cast stones and threw dust at him. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. So there, they continue to move along, and Abishai, who is the brother of Joab, so Joab and Abishai have both been David's generals going way back to the time that David went into Philistia. So they've been with him a long time. And we've seen them in action on a number of occasions. They are quick to act. They're hot-blooded. And they are quick to put people to death. And Abishai thinks that in the current circumstances, the response is an obvious one. David is surrounded with armed men. And here we have this one individual walking along beside them, cursing David and throwing rocks at all of them. And Abishai says, "Why are we putting up with this? Let me just lop his head off." And David's response is, that's what you guys always say. That's your response always. And he says, no, that's not what we're going to do. He says, if he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Then David goes on and he says, here is a situation in which my own son wants to depose me. Certainly, this guy has greater grievances than my son does. And so why, it just stands to reason that at this point in time he would be cursing me. David says, let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him. So David thinks that these curses are put in Shimei's mouth. They are what David should hear. Then he goes on and says, perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and return good to me instead of this cursing this day. So David's thinking, perhaps God will look at my affliction and turn this around. But at this point in time, I will endure the curses that are being pronounced. So Shimei continues his activity as David and his men walk along. And it says, and the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. And I would guess that it was a long and tiring day to go through all of those experiences while he's quickly hiking out of Jerusalem with all of his entourage. Next section. Then Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, entered Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. Now it came about when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? Then Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord, this people, and all the men of Israel have chosen, his will I be, and with him I will remain. And besides, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? I have served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your advice. What shall we do? And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went in to his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel regarded by both David and Absalom. So Absalom, and probably soon after David had left, Absalom arrives in Jerusalem. And he runs into Hushai. And he knows that Hushai and David are good friends. So he's wondering why Hushai stayed behind. And Hushai's responses are all very clever in that all of them can be taken in a way that is true. He starts out with, long live the king. He's not saying who the king is. But he's suggesting that he has gone over to Absalom's side, but he can in good conscience still say, long live the king. And Absalom says, well, where's your loyalty? Why aren't you loyal to your friend? And why didn't you go with him? And Hushai says, for whom the Lord, this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his will I be, and with him I will remain. In Hushai's mind, that's all referring to David rather than to Absalom. So Hushai convinces Absalom that has turned, that he will be loyal to Absalom and give good advice to him. So Hushai becomes one of Absalom's advisors along with Ahithophel. So Absalom is now thinking, okay, what should our next move be? We've come into Jerusalem, but David has fled. So now how do we, what steps do we take to solidify power in my hands? And he turns to Ahithophel for advice as to how to accomplish that. And Ahithophel's advice is typical, in a sense. What Hushai says is, you need to have sex with all of the concubines that David left behind. It was fairly common practice in the ancient world that when someone made the claim to be king in the place of someone else, that one way to establish that claim was to take the wives of the previous king and to have sex with them. David did not leave his wives behind, but he did leave 10 concubines. Concubines are not fully the status of a wife. They have a slightly lower status, but they are sometimes referred to as wives. And so this is the closest thing to David's wives that are available. And by sleeping with David's concubines, what Absalom is saying is, I am making an all-out effort to take the throne. There's no turning back at this point. Because by sleeping with David's wives, I am going to make myself, well, what is the word, odious? Odious to your father. He is clearly taking a step of no return by doing this. And by taking this step of no return, he is signaling to all of his supporters, this effort is an all-out effort. I am committing myself to this effort. If I fail in this effort, Absalom is saying, I will probably be killed. So I am making this an all-out effort, and therefore you, my followers, ought to do the same. And that's apparently what Absalom is trying to communicate to his followers. So that's what Absalom does in the sight of all Israel. If you'll recall, Nathan, after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, and after David had murdered Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, Nathan came to David and he said that David would have a difficult life from here on out. And the two specific things that he said was the sword will not depart from your house, and your comrade will sleep with your wives in the sight of all. So this, what Nathan had said would come to pass, that second part is clearly coming to pass here in what Absalom is doing. Then it points out that Ahithophel gave great advice. He had given great advice to David and continues to give great advice to Absalom. And I think what it means by great advice is he's smart. These are the right things to do to accomplish your purposes. Okay. I want to go back through this whole section, kind of rethink this whole section from two different perspectives. The first is, and the question that came to my mind as I was working through this passage is, how do we think about these events here? Who's doing right and who's doing wrong? And when are they doing right and when are they doing wrong? And why are they doing right and why are they doing wrong? And it gets complicated, and the author doesn't give an awful lot of clues. If you had been in Jerusalem, with whom would you have sided in this civil conflict? Would you have sided with Absalom, or would you have sided with David, and why? If you think about why one would side with Absalom, there are a number of reasons. One is, David's getting older. I don't know how old he is. We don't have a lot of information with respect to the chronology. But his sons, Absalom and Amnon, I can't remember whether both of them were born when David was king in Hebron or whether it was just Absalom that was born when he was king in Hebron. But at least one of them was born when he was king in Hebron. And now they're adults. So there's some 20 years since when he became king in Hebron at this point. So he's probably in his 50s somewhere when this is happening. And as we all know, that's getting over the hill. His justice may have been a little slow. We only saw one hint of this, but remember when the wise woman of Tekoa that Joab had set up came to David and presented the case. David's initial response was, "I'll take that case up." Well, you can see why someone would say, "Well, that's not speedy justice. I don't want to hear that you're willing to listen to the case. I want you to decide." Now, from my perspective, I would think, if I had been David, I would have said, "I will take up the case," because I would like to hear from the other side. I would like to get more details before making a judgment. But it could be that someone bringing a case before David would see that as not swift justice. It could also be argued that David doesn't always act wisely. Think back to his son's rape of his daughter. David was angry, but he didn't do anything. So is justice being granted? Is David doing the just thing? So it could be argued that he's not serving as a good judge for the nation of Israel. Furthermore, he is guilty of having done some horrendous things. He committed adultery. And he had Bathsheba's husband murdered. You can see how that would be disquieting to a kingdom, to the people of a kingdom, to have their king be guilty of such things. Furthermore, he's living under a curse. Nathan proclaimed a curse on David, saying, "The sword will not pass from your household, and your companion will sleep with your wives." Those are going to impact the whole nation, not just David. And you could see how someone could argue that it would be better to be freed and not be under that curse. Furthermore, there's every indication that Absalom would provide energetic leadership. He's a man of action, and I'm sure people are aware of that. He's young, he seems to be competent, and he's very attractive. He looks the part of a king. So all of those would be reasons why somebody might support Absalom in this civil turmoil. But on the other side of the coin, why might one side with David? I think that it's important to recognize that to rise up in a rebellion against the king is not the same as voting against the incumbent president in the United States. Those are very different things. that our whole system is set up to provide us with every 4 years an opportunity to voice our approval or disapproval of the president in charge. And furthermore, the whole system is set up to accommodate a change of leadership every 4 years with a minimum of disruption to the whole system. So ours is a system that's built on change of leadership. And in order to do that, there's a sense in which we limit what the president can do. He doesn't have as much power as a king has. It's much more constrained so that it's not so disruptive to change him. It's different in a hereditary monarchy. In a hereditary monarchy, change is designed to happen when the king dies. And the replacement is designated by biology. It's the oldest son, typically. It doesn't have to be the oldest son, but it's going to be a son of the king. And to do that is a major disruption. It's a major change when a king dies and his son takes over. And if you look at the history of kingdoms, if someone wants to stage some kind of rebellion, it will almost always happen when a king dies. That's the prime time to do it. So it's still disruptive, but it doesn't happen very often. So to rise up against David, this is not part of the system. This is a major step that would be taken to overthrow the king in power. Secondly, even though David has indeed done some horrible things, he was a man after God's own heart. And we can see that in a number, in the way that that David responds to things. There is a humility and a repentance there that is genuine and significant. And he has been forgiven by God, and God made that clear. So what we tend to see is that those who side with David side with him because they see his spirit. And they like the spirit that they see. So for them, the political issues aren't as significant as the spiritual status of the one that they are following. I think that's clearly the case with Ittai, the Philistine general who has come over. I think that's clearly the case with Zadok, the priest. And in Israel, we're not just talking about any old king, but we're talking about the anointed of God. He is the ordained ruler of God's people. So to rise up against David is not the same as rising up against any other king. This is rising up against the king of God's people and the anointed of God. If you'll recall, when David was fleeing from Saul, there were several occasions when he could have killed Saul, and he refused to do so. That would have been an easy solution to the situation, but he refused to do so. Why? Because Saul was God's anointed. David took that very seriously. That was true with Ishbosheth also. After Saul had been killed, his son Ishbosheth became king in Israel, and David refused to take action against him and put him to death. So if you'll recall, it was a couple of Ishbosheth's lieutenants who rose up against him and killed him, and they reported that to David, and David was furious. And if I'm not mistaken, David had them put to death because of what they had done. So David takes very seriously, and he took this seriously even before he became king, that the God-appointed ruler of Israel is a significant status, and that such a one ought not be put to death. So I think, as we read through the text, I think that we are to see that those who are looking at things from a spiritual perspective are seeing that David is the king, and he ought not be rebelled against. He's the one that ought to rule until God changes that, and that we as people ought not make that change. The other thing I want to look at is, what is David's experience? If you think of David, what he's going through this, I think that's particularly interesting. He had done wrong, and he's aware of the wrong that he had done. His conscience is to one degree or another plagued by what he had done. Remember, God had told him his life would be spared, but he would have these bad things that would happen. Interestingly, Nathan wasn't more specific. So David knows that these bad things are going to happen, but he only knows in kind of general terms what that's going to look like. How would one live with that kind of knowledge? Think, just do a little thought experiment. What if I were to tell you that your oldest child would die in an automobile accident? The temptation would be to go to an island where there are no cars and to go there without using a car. But to try to avoid that eventuality. But clearly, if God is the maker of the universe, and he says that your son is going to die in an automobile accident, it doesn't matter where you go, it's going to happen. So a kind of paranoid protectionism is not going to work. There's no way that you're going to be so careful that what God has said will come to pass will not happen. The other end of the spectrum, then, would be a kind of fatalism. Well, then what's anything worth? I mean, there's nothing I can do. This misery is going to come upon me. I might as well just give up. But man, a person can't live life that way. It's not healthy. It's not livable. So it's going to have to be some kind of middle ground, and I think that's the middle ground that David has landed on. That, first of all, perhaps God will change his mind. Perhaps God will be relenting. Perhaps it'll only be part of what God has promised that he would do. If you'll recall, Bathsheba had a child, had a son, after they had committed adultery. And Nathan said, the child will die. And soon thereafter, the child got sick. And David went into prayer and fasting constantly, for praying for the life of the child. And he was doing so fervently that when the child did die, none of the servants wanted to report it to him because they were afraid of what he might do to himself. But when he did learn of it, he got up, he washed his face, and he went on with his business. And everybody's thinking, well, why the quick turnaround? We thought you were serious in your mourning for and your fervency in prayers for the child. And David's response was, well, I thought there was a chance that God would relent, but he didn't. So now we go on. So it could be that David, in the back of his mind, is thinking, perhaps God will relent. Perhaps not all of this misery will happen. But even if it does, I think it has to be the case that David's perspective is, the misery that's coming, knowing God as I know him, it will be productive misery. That is to say, that whatever's going to come to pass, God is working through it in such a way that good things will be accomplished in my soul as a result of this misery. That it won't be pointless misery. It won't be just pain, but it will be instructive and it will be beneficial in that sense. Painful, yes, but instructive and productive. It's like cancer treatment, which is no fun, but it's for a purpose. And to the extent that it's for a purpose, then that makes it a whole different kind of thing than if it were absolutely purposeless. So I think that's David's perspective on things as these events start. When the messenger comes into Jerusalem, I think David was shocked. I don't think he really thought that Absalom would do such a thing. Now, as Logan pointed out last week, in all probability, it would have been known to a lot of people in Jerusalem that Absalom was campaigning, at least for the position of judge, if not for the position of king. That Absalom is doing some political maneuvering that is a threat to David. But there's no inkling here that David took such a threat seriously. My guess is David's thinking, oh, he would never do that. He would never go that far. In any case, David seems to be surprised. He certainly isn't prepared. And he's trying to think, what do I do? And his first response is, his first thought is, you know, I could die here. This could be, that could be what's going to happen. And that would be consistent with what Nathan had told him. There's nothing in what Nathan said that would suggest otherwise. This was all a possible outcome. And I think that David is seeing this as a very possible outcome. But David takes just prudent measures, what would make the most sense to do in this at this juncture, and decides that fleeing Jerusalem would be the best thing to do. Making provision for those that stay behind, trying to take into account the fate of each of his of those who have been loyal to him. What would be best for them? Then as he leaves, we have this picture of a little bit of good news, a little bit of bad news, a little bit of good news. It's the bad news. Bad news seems to come first. He must have been shocked at the ardent support for the rebellion. That must have been a real blow to him. And you can imagine him getting more and more discouraged as they're leaving Jerusalem. The news of Ahithophel must have been a shock to him and a very disappointing. And even worse would have been the news of Mephibosheth. But along the way, and interspersed with that, are these encouraging things, encouraging developments. The fact that the Philistine Ittai wants to go with him must have been encouraging. That Zadok and Abiathar want to go with him must have been encouraging. That Hushai is remaining loyal to him must have been encouraging. And that Ziba is providing provisions for him must have been encouraging. So it's a combination of both good news and bad news, but all in all, it must have been primarily discouraging. So when it gets to the point where he's walking along and Shimei is walking along beside him and cursing him and throwing stones at him, David's thinking, I deserve this. Everything that he's saying, I deserve this. I deserve every stone. I deserve all the dust that he's throwing. And I think David is feeling like he brought this upon him by the things that he had done. But if you look at what Shimei says, it's not justified. If you want to point at things that David did that are wrong, there are a number of things that you can point at. But to point to David and say that he is the responsible for the bloodshed that was inflicted on the house of Saul, if you look back through the accounts in 1 and 2 Samuel, David went out of his way to not bring bloodshed to Saul's household. So what Shimei is saying is not justified. But David must have been, and David's response to Shimei, I think, indicates that he was very discouraged by what was happening. But later he becomes encouraged, and I'll read this very quickly and just make a couple of comments. One of the Psalms was written while he was fleeing from Absalom. It's Psalm 3. Actually, there's the possibility that about 5 psalms were written during this time, but this is the only one that is definitely written at this time, and we know so because it says so. Psalm 3, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. I'll just read it. O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God, Selah. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain, Selah. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Rise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all my enemies on the cheek. Thou hast shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Thy blessing be upon thy people, Selah. So apparently at this point in time, he has reached a measure of resolution and has been encouraged. You can see at the beginning of the psalm his discouragement that there is so much opposition to his rule. But as he proceeds through the psalm, he's reassured by God that God will protect him and that God will save him and defeat his enemies. Okay. I need to stop there. I'll take just a couple questions or comments.
You seem to think that Hushai was pretty concerned with not lying.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd have gone in as a spy for David, I would have lied like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he was so concerned with not lying?
I don't know. I don't think that it is necessarily wrong to lie. But that is a tricky question. Even if lying can be in certain circumstances be justifiable, that doesn't make it easier to do. I think it can be very hard to lie. I wouldn't be surprised, but that's his situation. So he feels much better about saying things that construed one way are true, but he wants them to be construed another way by Absalom. It's still deceptive, but I think it's easier to do.
He says, and all these men here agreeing that you are king? I would assume that all the men there would have thought that Absalom was king. That would appear to be a lie.
What's he say? Did you have it there?
Nope, not precisely. Regardless, I will find it later.
Pardon?
I can look for it later and come to you.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier about the way that David he never laid a hand on Saul, really respected his office.
Yes.
And even though he loved the life as the son of God, David lived the life as the son of God and had all these prophets around him in circumstances that rose him to the place he was. He never, ever seems to give himself that same sort of confidence that people will look at him and not raise their hand against him. He's on the move. He's fleeing. He apparently, well, I want to get your take on it. It looks to me like he's just, his reverence to the office must have been unique to very few people. Mm-hmm. And he's counted himself as one of them, but most people, when it comes to the kingdom of Israel, look at it as any other political office, any other political kingdom.
Right.
But that's my take. I wanted to see what you think.
I think that's right. And I think that's part of what's driving David, is that he sees this as a very real possibility that he would be deposed and put to death. And that, and I think that that's what's significant here, is that the people who side with David are the kind of people that are sensitive to that kind of issue, that the anointed is God's anointed, and you don't mess with God's anointed. But the majority of people in Israel don't seem to be of that same perspective. They don't see it that same way. Mm-hmm.
I just thought of this. Where's David's faith in? He has faith in Saul's kingship, but where's his own? Value of his own, what he thinks he is to God, and what kind of, I'm fishing for thoughts here. Your thoughts? What kind of power God will protect him with?
I don't think he sees the fact that he is God's anointed as some kind of guarantee that he won't be killed by his son. That could be the way that God would end his reign. I think he sees that as a very real possibility. Or some other wicked person killing the anointed. That can always happen. And God can bring that about. I think he sees that as a real possibility. But he himself would not take that kind of action towards God's anointed.
There's nothing in the Davidic covenant between his relationship with his maker that would give him any kind of protection that he would see.
I'm not aware of any guarantees that he has that he would not be put to death by somebody.